Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Miller v. Safeco Insurance. Ms. Reiter.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Alyssa Reiter on behalf of the appellant, Safeco Insurance Company. This is an appeal from a bad faith and breach of contract judgment in favor of the insureds, the Millers, and against Safeco in a first-party property damage bad faith case under Wisconsin law. And while this appeal was being briefed, an important case was decided by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, a bad faith case called Bretthorst versus Allstate, issued on June 14th of this year. And I'd like to spend a little time talking about that Bretthorst case because I think that the
file a Rule 28 letter.
I'm sorry?
Or was this in your brief?
The Bretthorst case was cited in the reply brief.
Okay.
It was issued 3 days before the appellees filed their brief, and I found it while working on the reply brief, so it has been cited. But I do want to spend some time discussing that Bretthorst case because it discussed various issues of Wisconsin coverage law and bad faith law that really set the stage for most of the issues that we've raised in our brief today. Bretthorst was an uninsured motorist case where the plaintiff insured sued her UM carrier for bad faith, and that was her only cause of action. And the narrow issue that the court was dealing with was the trial court's denial of a motion to bifurcate the contract issues in the case from the bad faith issues, and the court was considering, could you even have a cause of action just for bad faith without having also a breach of contract cause of action? And the court held that you could under certain conditions, and the way that they reached that conclusion and the holdings that they made are important for our analysis today. And there's three paragraphs in particular in Bretthorst that I wanted to highlight to the court, and then I would like to come back to those paragraphs and show how they relate to each of our substantive arguments. First is in paragraph 56, where the court held that first-party bad faith in Wisconsin cannot exist without some wrongful denial of a contract benefit. The second is in paragraph 66, where the court held that even bad faith conduct on the part of an insurance company cannot create coverage that doesn't otherwise exist. And the third is in paragraph 68, where the court explained that the reason that you can't create coverage through bad faith conduct is because the Wisconsin rule and principle of law is that you don't bind an insurance company to a risk that it never contemplated. And this is how Bretthorst is important to our case. First, obviously on the bad faith issue, which is the third argument in our brief. On the issue of bad faith, the Wisconsin Supreme Court held that a breach of contract, a breach of the insurance contract, is a fundamental prerequisite to a first-party bad faith case. And this is where it's really important. There's been a dispute between the parties, and the district court really adhered to the plaintiff's view on this, that although the plaintiffs ostensibly recognize that there's an objective and a subjective component to bad faith, they wanted to view the issue of was there an underlying breach of contract solely from the perspective of exactly what issues or exclusions or provisions was the particular claims analyst who was handling this claim looking at when she decided to deny coverage. And so the district court limited its analysis of whether objectively there was a reasonable basis to deny coverage to only what it viewed as the four grounds that the claims analyst had relied on. And what Bretthorst instructs us is that we have to look at, is there in fact or as a matter of law coverage or is there not? And it's a purely objective standard. And
right, but that issue was resolved against you in the district court.
But that's because the district court looked only at the four issues that the claims analyst said they had specifically.
The magistrate judge in the district court found, I thought, that Safeco breached the contract by failing to cover the loss. Isn't that right?
Well, the court...
Then why doesn't that give you the foundation for the further bad faith claim?
Well, the court did find that, and I'll get to that point next as to why we disagree with the court's decision on coverage. But when the court was considering the bad faith issue, it refused, when it looked at whether coverage was fairly debatable or not, which is the first prong of considering bad faith, it looked only at the four issues that the claims analyst said were discussed at this roundtable discussion when they decided to deny coverage, and refused to look at potentially applicable exclusions or other grounds.
Well, but the district court addressed that, right? But the exclusions by saying Wisconsin law was perfectly clear that if you had not disclosed the terms of the policy before the loss occurred, this all-risk policy, you could not rely on the exclusions that had never been disclosed to the insured, and that wasn't fairly debatable.
He did find that.
Is that wrong?
And we think that conclusion is wrong as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that Bretthorst also helps explain why that conclusion was wrong. In Bretthorst, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that even bad faith conduct cannot create coverage that doesn't otherwise exist. And this supports the principle that we've been espousing all along in our briefs and below, that under cases such as Shannon, which is a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, that you can't create coverage that doesn't otherwise exist through some sort of estoppel analysis, which is essentially what the district court was doing.
Let me ask you about that. You all are pitching this as estoppel. As I was reading the briefs, frankly, I was thinking of it more in terms of an insurer, or rather a kind of standard breach of contract battle of the forms. The question is, were the exclusions ever actually part of the contract between the parties? It's not a question of estoppel. The insured was never told that those were part of the policy.
Well, I don't think there's any issue about whether the terms were in fact part of the policy or not.
We know they were printed in the policy, but that policy was never provided until after the loss had been incurred, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So we assume an insurance company could not come in and amend the policy after the loss has occurred to exclude something, right?
That's probably true.
Right. Okay. Isn't that, from the insured's perspective, what happened here? Because they were never told about these. It's not a question of estoppel. It's just that you never told them that this is part of the agreement. You never had a meeting of the minds as to the exclusions.
Well, I don't think that's...
That's Kozlik, right?
I don't think that is the basis of the Kozlik decision. The Kozlik decision, if you look at it, really is premised on two other things. One is that the contract and the rental agreement itself required that the insured be given a copy of
The court didn't rely on that. I mean, it stands for a pretty simple proposition that the insurance company can't rely on terms that it never disclosed to the insured.
But
what's the problem with that?
Another important aspect of the Kozlik decision and reasoning was that there was this view that the insured could have conformed his conduct, changed his conduct to avoid the exclusions or fall within the insuring language had he known. And so even if the court didn't use the term estoppel and didn't discuss it in those explicit terms, there was this underlying premise that there was some sort of detrimental reliance. In our case, because our position is that this house was a total loss before the Millers ever purchased the property.
Arguments about detrimental reliance matter only if this is an estoppel. And I repeat the question of my colleague. Forget about insurance for a moment. Suppose there is a contract between A and B, and the contract as first handed over doesn't include any language about warranty, about the terms of warranty. And under the UCC, that means there's an unlimited warranty of merchantability. And then a year later, one side hands the other a revised version of the contract that says, actually, there's a 30-day warranty. Now, which thing will cover the case if the product breaks after 6 months? Will it be the UCC off-the-rack warranty, or will it be the 30-day warranty that was delivered sometime after the product broke? No one would think of that as a question of estoppel. It would just be a question of what was in the contract, right?
Well, the I think the situation is different with the UCC because it's a code and it sets
actually,
out...
That respect to the UCC just repeats the common law rule. There's an unlimited warranty of merchantability unless the warranty is disclaimed or limited in a written contract. But, by the way, doesn't Safeco make these contracts available on the Internet? You put the terms of the policy on the Internet, and then when somebody gets insurance, you say, if you want to see the full terms of the policy instantly, go to this URL.
I don't know, as a matter of fact, whether they're on the Internet or not. But...
You all argued in your brief that it would have been impossible to provide the policy to the insured before the closing on the transaction. I didn't understand that.
Well, what we were saying was that until the Millers actually purchased the house, there's not an insurable interest. And so,
but you can't tell them what the terms of the contract are?
You could, and in fact,
yes, you could post them on the Internet, and the entire world could know the terms of the contract, right?
And there was
this
some
a form contract.
And there was some evidence in this record, in fact, that the Millers had purchased policies from Safeco in the past, and so they did have notice of the.
No, policies purchased in the past are policies purchased in the past, right? You need to know what the terms of this policy are. And it's perfectly easy to give somebody a copy of the policy before its effective date. It's easy to put it on the Internet so the entire world can see what the current form is. And as soon as I reached that argument in your brief, I began to treat your brief as facetious. Right? You're just joking with the court when you make an argument like we couldn't give them the terms of the policy until there was an insurable interest.
Well, I think what the brief said was that this particular policy couldn't issue, not that...
The policy couldn't issue, but you can give them the terms of the policy. They can have the policy in their hands, read it to their heart's content. It just can't take effect until they have an insurable interest.
Doesn't your binder say anything about the terms of the policy or exclusions?
I'm not sure, but I think that the more important question, the practical question and legal question here is what difference it would have made, because if the house was
in... Now we're back to estoppel.
Well, again, I think that the Kozlik decision, although it doesn't use the term estoppel, it's basically what it's finding is that the reason we have to have this rule, to the extent that it says that it's a rule, that you need to have the policy in hand before the insurance company can enforce the exclusion, is because this underlying assumption that the insured could change his or her behavior to conform to the policy, and that just is an impossibility on these facts. And so even if...
If you come back to my example about the warranty, the product broke, right? The buyer isn't changing his behavior or not. We just need to know what the terms of the warranty are. Can one say there was a 30-day limited warranty when the terms of the warranty were not delivered until after the product broke? It just seems to me... has nothing to do with estoppel. It just has to do with what were the terms of the contract. You might want to move on to some other argument.
Okay. Well, this might be a good time to move on to the issue of whether there ever was any initial trigger or grant of coverage in the first place, because, of course, if there's no covered event, then we don't even get to the next step of whether there were exclusions that would have barred the coverage. And, again, this also relates back to this Bredhorst case where the court said that the whole reason that we shouldn't be using an insurance company's conduct to create coverage that might not exist is because Wisconsin law does not allow us to bind an insurance company to a risk that it never contemplated, that it didn't get premiums for. And the risk contemplated in this policy was, according to its terms of the contract, accidental direct physical loss to property. And the loss had to occur during the policy period. And it was the insured's task to show, in the first place, that they fell within this insuring language. And after the evidence was presented and the court made findings of fact, it became clear that this was not an accidental loss during this policy period. This was a chronic, ongoing problem that had rendered the house a total loss before it was ever purchased. I see my rebuttal time's up. I'd like to reserve.
If you could, I'd like to ask you, though, about that point, now that you're finally to the first point, which is coverage. I understand you all to be arguing against the so-called continuous trigger or continuous coverage theory, and arguing that we should distinguish, or Wisconsin law should distinguish, between third-party liability coverage and first-party property coverage for these purposes. On that point, you cited not Wisconsin law, but a New Jersey case, the Winding Hills case, and a California case, Prudential against Superior Court. Both of those cases in the first-party insurance coverage context rejected continuous coverage with this kind of chronic, ongoing damage to the property. But they both adopted the manifestation theory. And if that's correct, if those are the cases we should rely on as guides to Wisconsin law, it would seem that when the problem manifested itself, it was during your policy period.
Well, we cited those cases not so much to ask this court to adopt any particular trigger in a first-party context, but to point out why this whole third-party continuous trigger theory was a red herring.
But does any, you all are saying distinguish between third-party and first-party, and the courts that have done so have ruled against your position, the ones that have separated it. Have any courts adopted or rejected the manifestation theory in that context and said, no, we're going to hang the loss on the insurance company that had this property 5 years ago when the loss began?
Well, I would say if you look at the case we cited, I think it was Leafland, where
Mexico case.
I'm sorry?
Mexico case.
Yes. Which is at 881 Pacific 2nd 26. In Leafland, it's not so much that they adopted some other trigger theory, but it really makes the point that we're trying to make, which is that you don't even get to which of multiple policies is triggered, because when it's clear that whatever occurred occurred long before your policy issued and there was never any accidental event during your policy period, then your policy isn't triggered. The insuring language isn't satisfied. And so you don't have to get to the next question of, well, between multiple potentially applicable policies, which or all of them are triggered, because the policy isn't triggered in the first place because it wasn't intended to cover this type of situation. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal, if I could.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Allen.
Good morning. Any coverage issue is not the most interesting reading, and so the briefs in this case are relatively long, but I do believe that the issues all boil down to two-minute issues that are relatively easy for this court to address. Question number one is whether or not it's possible to harmonize Shannon and Kozlik, and I think the answer to that question clearly lies in the Gross decision. The Gross decision was issued by the Wisconsin Supreme Court 4.5 years prior to the Shannon decision. 8 of the justices are the same. The Shannon decision was written by Justice Cece. The concurrence of the Gross decision was written by Justice Cece. Justice Cece in the Shannon decision, this estoppel case, fairly clearly breaks out in the fourth to the last paragraph and makes an exception indicating notice had been provided in that case. In the Gross case, a contract of adhesion case, Justice Cici in the concurrence indicates that he agrees with the majority's view on the issue of notice. The Wisconsin Supreme Court's position is clear if these two decisions are read together. They view these as two different situations. The contract of adhesion issue goes to the basic issue and question of whether or not there's a meeting of the minds. The issue of estoppel is a conduct-based defense, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court viewed them as different things. The second issue for this court to address is the concept of fortuity and whether it really matters. Now, the first brief filed by the appellants, by Safeco in this case, cited Lotz, and they cited a question in Lotz where the Lotz court said, how would we resolve a latent defect case involving this concept of fortuity? The definition, though, of the covered loss in the Lotz case, if you look immediately prior to that sentence, actually is the old form fortuity language. It uses the words fortuity. While the Lotz case was pending on motion, the Wisconsin Supreme Court issued the American Girl decision. And the American Girl decision used the definition accident, one that is direct physical loss, an accidental direct physical loss, very similar to the one that is involved in the Miller policy. The Lotz court looked at resolving the question of fortuity by looking at the American Girl case, which defined the definition of accident, and then also looked at the known loss doctrine. Frankly, I think the whole first section of the brief is really a red herring, because we're dealing here with a definition of direct physical loss using the word accident. That's the word in the policy. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the American Girl case gave very specific directions as to how that term should be defined, whether the cause or harm was intended, anticipated, or expected. And in Judge Callahan's decision, he makes specific factual findings as to whether or not the loss was intended, anticipated, or expected. He uses a policy similar to American Girl. He goes through the same process, and he makes specific fact findings. Really, what the appellants are contesting right now are those specific fact findings, and that's what makes this portion of their appeal, I think, inappropriate. Now, a final question has arisen with respect to some of the questions that were raised to Safeco's counsel. There is nothing in the record indicating that a binder was ever presented, and no argument was made below that the binder somehow contained or provided notices of the terms of the policy. Although it is correct that if you go on the website now for Safeco, you can see their property damage policies. However, that process, ironically, did not start until about 30 days after Judge Callahan issued this decision. There is nothing in the record that...
I don't know whether there's a causal connection between this decision and the appearance of the terms on the web.
There's nothing in the record that indicates that there was any type of notice that was provided to the Millers. In addition, Safeco argues in its brief that somehow these are standard exclusions that are contained in these policies. And that's contrary to the specific findings made by Judge Callahan on AA-52. In fact, it was specifically noted at trial that the seepage exclusion, the primary exclusion that's being asserted here, was actually on an amendment to a Wisconsin policy. And that Deidre Clare testified at trial that this was something new that she hadn't dealt with before. And Judge Callahan even makes some specific comments about in the coverage denial letter that even Safeco apparently didn't know how to handle this issue. The actual testimony also was from the adjuster that none of these provisions in her experience were the standard provisions, that they were dealing with something new. That was at record at 186 at page 243. Now, it's also correct that if you actually physically compare... Some argument was made that because the Millers were Safeco customers in the year 1998 and 1999, they went on to another carrier and then came back to Safeco, that somehow they still had notice of Safeco's general provisions. But the record also supported the fact that those provisions had changed during that time period. So all of this cries out for the precise questions that this court was asking, which is relying on some type of notice based on prior policies, it just isn't practical here. It's not that hard for a carrier to deliver a policy, at or immediately after the time that is purchased so that the insurer can look at it and make decisions with respect to that policy.
Can you tell us about the status of claims against other interested parties such as the seller or its insurer?
Sure. There is still a claim that is set for trial against the seller, and it is set for trial for later this year.
Is there a claim against the inspector?
There is no claim against the inspector, no.
What's the claim against the seller?
There was a prior real estate condition report associated with a prior attempted sale by the seller before the Millers became involved 2 years before, in which the inspector did find some of the conditions that were on one of the walls in the house. And that's the basis of the claim against the seller, that it was concealed. The testimony is in the record, actually, for this case before Judge Callahan, that specific wall, the photos actually in the record, had been painted over, and that was the concealment.
Hmm. Okay. I would like you to get to the punitive damages issue. And I think Judge Callahan's finding that the particular reason given was a bad one is, you know, it's a finding of fact. It's hard to say it's clearly erroneous. But as I understand Wisconsin law, punitive damages are available only if the adjuster was acted subjectively, knowing that the claim should have been allowed. I didn't see a finding that Judge Callahan made that the adjuster subjectively knew that the seepage exclusion couldn't be applied. Did he make the finding, if I misread him?
No, there is no word subjective in the decision.
Yeah, isn't that a problem? We've got an award of punitive damages under state law that requires subjective bad faith as well as an objective error, and there's no finding of subjective bad faith.
Well, one of the areas where subjective bad faith can be found is just in the concept of recklessness. That's what the Anderson court indicates. And there are findings
the adjuster thought the seepage exclusion applied, of course the adjuster was denying the claim long before Judge Callahan said the seepage exclusion didn't apply. And actually, for all we know, the adjuster thought the policy had been delivered on time. Right? So if the adjuster thought the seepage exclusion applied, how could he have been acting in bad faith?
Sure. The adjuster in this case never physically came to the property. The adjuster in this case, and it is in the record and in Judge Callahan's decision, the adjuster elected to send Mike Midas, somebody who was a construction expert in-house at Safeco, the seepage exclusion was never investigated. So the findings that are in the case are that although the seepage exclusion was asserted, it wasn't based upon any investigation, not a reckless investigation. It wasn't based upon any actual inquiry by the person who came out to the site.
One wonders, though, given the description of what the loss was, how could the seepage exclusion not have applied?
Well, ironically, during the interview, Deidre Cleary only did two things as part of her investigation. She conducted an 8-minute interview in which she asked no questions about cause, about seepage, or relating to any of the exclusions. All of her questions dealt with whether or not there had been some sort of disclosure that was in the Summit property condition report. So she asked no questions that laid the foundation for any of these exclusions. She then did not have a conversation with Mr. Mike Midas. She sent him an email. He went out to the site, and then he also did not investigate any of these exclusions. And those findings are in Judge Callahan's decision, and I think that is the basis of his punitive damage award.
Can I stop you right there?
Sure.
Maybe I'm missing some. I thought there are bad faith damages, but I didn't think they were punitive damages.
There are no punitive damages. There's attorney's fees.
I'm sorry. I misspoke. Damages turn out to be.
I expect to see punitive damages
right.
in a bad faith case, frankly.
No, it's my error in misstating this.
But we're talking about consequential damages, in essence, actual damages.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks. That's helpful.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the revision of the prejudgment interest. Wasn't that a new theory you came up with after the judgment?
That's a good question. And the answer to that is, I think, exactly what we said to Judge Callahan and what he said in his decision. It's not entirely a new issue. We did move on summary judgment for interest, but the motion for summary judgment specifically indicated that we could not push back an interest finding to a date prior to the court's decision on coverage. The motion said the court's now decided coverage. It's no longer disputed that there is coverage. Interest should run from the date of that coverage decision. But that motion indicated that we reserve the right to go back if we could prove at the bad faith trial that the decision had become known, that there should have been coverage, which is the statutory standard, at an earlier date. At the time that that motion's filed, we didn't have the coverage file.
That's an argument you could have made before, on the same evidence before the judgment was entered, wasn't it?
Well, then there was an argument made before the judgment was ever entered. It was actually in closing arguments for a specific computation with respect to that interest award. We then did go back on motion and adjust the computational method because of an error, as we indicated, that was in my request that I made to the court. We just went back to the wrong date. And so we did go back and request what amounted to be an additional $15,000 beyond that was made in the original request. But it was an error. There is no disputing.
I understood your position on that to be, in essence, we screwed up. If the court had denied your request, you wouldn't have had a leg to stand on because of the but that he had the discretion to allow you to correct the error.
Truth is, Your Honor, I needed glasses and I misread my notes. That being said, if there are any other questions, otherwise I have no further argument to present to the court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Ryder?
I would just make one concluding remark that the court asked about the status of this misrepresentation case against the seller of the property, and I would just note that the very fact that there is a misrepresentation case against the seller really underscores our argument as to why there's no coverage under our policy to begin with.
Shouldn't you guys be linking arms with the Millers and joining in that suit?
We are involved in that suit. That's a whole other question, but I think the important point is that the very fact that the Millers are suing the prior owner for her knowing about a patent condition which she then tried to conceal from them, and the fact that this loss had already taken place before she sold it to them proves or at least supports our argument that this house was a total loss. It was already damaged. The damage had occurred by the time that the policy ever issued in the first place, and therefore it never could trigger coverage under our policy.
Have Wisconsin courts held in this kind of a situation before that, or have other courts held that a pursuit of a fraud or misrepresentation or concealment claim undermines a coverage claim?
I don't know if there's a case that's addressed that specific issue, but I do know it's not just the filing of the suit, but the testimony in this case, which we've cited in our brief, that shows as well that there was no covered event, no accidental physical loss that took place that caused that had a causative effect on damaging the property within our policy period. For all the reasons we stated in our brief, we'd ask for the relief we requested, which is that you vacate, reverse the judgment, and enter judgment in favor of Safeco or for the alternative relief that we requested. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.